Hello, Peter Pearls listeners, and welcome to a brand new podcast called Unraveling HS, Exploring Hidradenitis Suppurativa Research. It's a new podcast Peter created dedicated to shedding light on the often misunderstood world of hidradenitis suppurativa. Join Dr. Colleen Cotton and Dr. Irene Lara Corrales as they explore the challenges and triumphs of researching and treating this disease, particularly as it relates to early onset and diagnosis of HS in children and adolescents. Together with esteemed guests, they will delve into the different aspects of early onset HS, from the emotional toll of the condition and the latest research projects to the perspectives of patients and industry representatives. This program aims to foster understanding and awareness to advance research efforts and treatment options in this devastating condition. Before we begin, it's important to note that this podcast is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment, and any decisions related to medical care should be made in consultation with a qualified healthcare provider. Now, I'd like to introduce you to your program hosts. Dr. Irene Lara Corrales is an associate professor of pediatrics at the University of Toronto and staff physician at the Hospital for Sick Children. She's also co-chair for PEDRA's Acne and HS Focus Study Group. Along with her is Dr. Colleen Cotton, who also co-chairs PEDRA's Acne and HS Focus Study Group. Dr. Cotton is an assistant professor of dermatology and pediatrics at George Washington School of Medicine and Health Sciences and a pediatric dermatologist at Children's National Hospital in Washington, D.C. Thank you both so much for organizing and hosting this series. I will turn it over to you.
Thank you so much, Jen. We are really excited. I'm so pleased to introduce our guest speaker today, Dr. Haley Nayak. Dr. Nayak is an associate professor of dermatology and vice chair for health equity in the Department of Dermatology at the University of California, San Francisco. Dr. Nayak is trained both in dermatology and in clinical investigative methods. She is a leader in immune-mediated skin disease research and has published several impactful papers about hidradenitis suppurativa, which we will discuss today. Thank you so much for joining our discussion today, Dr. Nayak.
Oh, it's my great pleasure to be invited to have this conversation today. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Haley, for being here. So to start our conversation, would you be able to define hidradenitis suppurativa for our listeners?
Sure, I'd be happy to. I think our current understanding of hidradenitis suppurativa is that it's a chronic inflammatory condition that is characterized by inflammatory nodules and inflammatory abscesses that can go on to the development of dermal tunnels in the intertriginous body sites, so the armpits, the groin, the buttocks, and the inframammary folds. This is a condition that can be exquisitely painful and typically has its onset in adolescence. And for the people that are affected by this condition, because its onset is typically in adolescence, this is a condition that can really impact the trajectory of an individual's life. We know that HS is a prevalent inflammatory condition with prevalence on par with that of some of the other prevalent diseases that we care for in dermatology, including psoriasis, which impacts 1-2% of the U.S. population. And unfortunately, it's a condition that disproportionately affects women and Black Americans.
So one of the things that we wanted to start chatting about is the diagnosis of pediatric HS. We sometimes struggle because it is sometimes overseen or sometimes delayed diagnosis. And we were wondering if you could start by chatting with us about what are some of the challenges in diagnosing HS in pediatric patients.
Yeah, I think this is a great question. And this is really kind of where it starts, right? We can't really treat a condition if we haven't accurately diagnosed it. And this has been one of the main hurdles that we've encountered in taking care of HS patients, whether they're pediatric or adults. I think one of the main hurdles we face is just recognition and disease awareness of HS. We often kind of half-heartedly joke that hidradenitis suppurativa needs a new name because it's a real mouthful. I think the point here really is that we as a society, as a medical community, need to do a better job of raising awareness of this condition that we now know is quite prevalent in the United States, affecting as high as 1% of the U.S. population, and making sure that our frontline providers, our acute care physicians, pediatricians, primary care physicians, are familiar with this condition and also, frankly, are familiar with at least the existing diagnostic criteria of HS so that they can apply it in patients who are coming in with recurrent lesions that might be concerning for HS. So I think that is one of kind of the main barriers, recognition by people who are knowledgeable and on the front lines and kind of most likely to see HS when it comes into the clinic. I think another big barrier, and this is kind of tied to increasing disease awareness, is just getting people to come in for evaluation of these lesions. Often HS occurs in areas that, you know, are private or sensitive, in the groin, in the armpits, under the breasts, and both adults and young people are maybe reluctant to come in for evaluation of these lesions and may think that they have something to do with something they've done to their bodies, whether it's hygiene related, exercise related, or something else. And I think really kind of raising awareness of HS may reduce the stigma associated with it and associated with these lesions so that people are more likely to come in for treatment.
I think those are really good points. You mentioned the diagnostic criteria, and I do want to go to that because that was one of the papers that you actually published, was looking at applying the current criteria that exists to pediatric patients and showing that about half of them don't necessarily meet this requirement. And are the three diagnostic criteria, like they have the characteristic lesions, they have the characteristic locations, but that recurrence of at least two episodes within a 6-month time period may not really be appropriate, especially early on in the disease course. So how, you touched a little bit on this in the paper, but how do you think we can modify these criteria to capture pediatric patients earlier? And then something I struggle with, if we do expand those criteria, how do we make sure we're not including kids with folliculitis or kids who get irritant boils because of the deodorant that they're using and all they have to do is change that and it's gone?
Yeah, I think this is a great question. And I think a question that we just started to scratch the surface of in that paper that was published in JAMA Dermatology. So I want to just kind of make a couple points here. One is that one thing that that paper highlights is that providers didn't necessarily even capture recurrence of these lesions, right? So kind of going back to diagnostic criteria, an important part of applying diagnostic criteria is knowing that diagnostic criteria exist for this condition and collecting the information needed to apply diagnostic criteria. So I think as a medical community, dermatologists in particular could do a better job, and I think are trying to do a better job of making sure that our frontline provider partners are aware of HS diagnostic criteria and can ascertain that information in the context of, you know, talking with patients and better understand if these are recurrent lesions or kind of singular lesions. I think that's kind of one piece. And then in terms of how we modify these diagnostic criteria, I think it's also kind of important to understand the context in which these criteria came about. So these are really expert consensus derived diagnostic criteria based on the experience of experts, but not at the time that they were developed, not based on, you know, large scale population level evidence about diagnosis or disease course. And I think that's an important point because now that there is more awareness about HS, more people thinking about this condition and more patients coming forward saying, hey, I have this thing that happens with my body and I think I might have HS, and getting diagnosed earlier in their disease course, we have a real opportunity to take a data-driven approach to developing diagnostic criteria that are applicable to patients kind of regardless of where they're at on the spectrum of age, but also think about whether we need different diagnostic criteria for pediatric patients compared with those that we have for adults. And actually, this is something I learned from my pediatric dermatology colleagues from you all. It seems to me that some of the criteria that you all use to diagnose HS really are quite different than those that we use when we diagnose adults with HS, for example, really like looking for comedonal predominance. And so I wonder kind of how you all have thought about the current diagnostic criteria and how applicable they are to your pediatric patients. And if there are things that you consider that are not part of the diagnostic criteria that you think should be included for pediatric and adolescent patients.
I think that is a great point. Because sometimes when we're looking early, we just find the comedones. And sometimes we are challenged if we should be calling this HS or not. And I don't think that we probably have a clear answer, but definitely something that needs to be considered and needs to be, if we treat these comedones and they're going to resolve and not progress to develop more severe disease. And I don't think we know. I think it is interesting, and we probably can think of patients that we have seen that just have a few comedones, and we follow them and treat them, and they don't develop kind of boils. They don't develop kind of more severe symptoms, but others do progress and do develop other things. And I don't think we know enough right now to be able to tell, but I think that with the current diagnostic criteria, and your paper showed this very nicely, like I think that our pediatric patients, like especially the kind of chronicity and timing of their disease, like many might be left out and not diagnosed with HS if we're strict with the criteria. So I do think that we probably need to revise or kind of tweak a little bit those diagnostic criteria with the pediatric patient in mind.
And something I feel like I'm noticing the more patients that I see is, you know, when we get them early, there are different phenotypes of HS, right? Like there are the kids who come in with the dilated comedones. And there are some kids who come in with no comedones, but they have pustules that are sterile and they don't grow anything. Well, we call both of those patients HS. And I think of it kind of like, you know, babies can have a different like cooing sound for I'm hungry versus I'm sleepy. But by the time you get to them screaming, like you can't tell the difference. It's just like, oh my gosh, it's out of control. So I do think we have an opportunity to better define these phenotypes in pediatric patients because we are seeing them from the beginning and we might be able to help figure out who is going to progress, what are those risk factors, and what treatments might work better for one of those subtypes versus the other, because I do think there's a difference. I just don't know what it is.
Yeah, I think those are, you know, really important points and really highlight a gap in our understanding of HS. HS disease progression, and ultimately kind of prognostic factors that can help us better determine what treatments people are going to be most responsive to, which is, I think, so critically important for us to think about, particularly, I mean, across HS patients writ large, but particularly in pediatric and adolescent HS patients, because we know, particularly with folks who are getting diagnosed or having disease onset early in their life, what this essentially means is that this is something that they will have to live with for the entire duration of their remaining duration of their life. And it is something that can fundamentally impact so much. It can impact their education attainment, their income, ultimate income attainment, and fundamentally change the trajectory of their lives. So we have a real opportunity early in this condition to really better identify folks who are going to need more aggressive treatment, be really forward thinking about applying those management strategies in this patient population. But kind of to the original question of what do we do with these diagnostic criteria for pediatric patients, there's an opportunity here for us to reimagine what these diagnostic criteria should look like in pediatric patients, really follow people closely over time and have a high index of suspicion for folks who come in with typical lesions in typical locations but don't neatly fit into the existing recurrence criterion, and take, as I said, a data-driven approach to determining what is the appropriate recurrence interval for pediatric patients. And I think really modify some of those secondary criteria, which in the existing diagnostic criteria, family history of HS and negative or no growth on bacterial cultures. I think thinking about modifying those secondary criteria to include some of the things that Irene, you mentioned, comedones or other features that may be more prominent in children and adolescents, may be another important thing to consider for diagnostic criteria for pediatric HS.
So definitely lots more that we need to look into and research to be able to improve what we have right now. One of the things that we were really excited to talk to you about is your HS clinic. So we know you have been doing this for quite a while. And as some of us have started our HS clinics and or are planning to start an HS clinic, we wanted to kind of get a sense from you of how you run your clinic. Like, what would, if I was a patient with HS and you were telling me what to expect when I'd come to see you, can you walk us through that process and tell us a little bit of how your clinic runs?
You know, I've changed the way my clinic runs over time to kind of optimize the way I like to do things. And I encourage people to take that approach, but I'm happy to share what we do in our practice at the University of California, San Francisco. So my appointments with HS patients, regardless of whether they are new or follow-up patients, are 30 minutes long. I think one of the most important things that I can offer people with HS is my time and a listening ear, and really trying to understand their experience of living with this condition to help optimize the treatment strategies that I'm going to offer them. I also am very mindful that by the time people get to me, say the majority of people have had multiple unsatisfactory or unsatisfying experiences with our healthcare system. So one of my main goals in our first appointment for sure, and subsequent appointments most certainly, is to build therapeutic rapport and try and build a really positive relationship with the healthcare provider who's knowledgeable about HS and can help relieve some, if not all, of the suffering that these people are going through because of their condition. I have certainly like a template where I ask about disease features like disease onset and areas that are affected and comorbidities and treatments and family history. But initially, I just let folks tell me about their HS, their experience of living with HS. And usually by the time they're done telling me, they've completed most of the things that are already in my template of things that I would need to know to help them manage their condition. I always ask about comorbidities and mental health comorbidities in particular, because that's a place I feel like we really as a specialty have an opportunity to intervene, and particularly in terms of trying to connect folks with counseling or primary care resources that can help in that area. And I always ask about how HS impacts their life, their ability, the things that they would like to do, the things they aren't able to do because of their HS, so that I can get a better picture of how this condition is really limiting them. The other thing that I've learned from my colleagues in recent years that I ask now with regularity is about social determinants of health, and specifically try and better understand kind of people's living situations, what kinds of access they have to food, you know, what kind of employment they have, and if they're able to afford their medications, and are they able to get to appointments with me? What are the barriers to getting to appointments? Because it helps me tailor management strategy, what kinds of meds I might give them, how often I might be able to see them, and how I can make sure that I'm able to monitor them, given everything else they have going on in their lives. And then we spend a significant amount of time in that, in our appointments, talking really about therapies and the real known risks of the existing therapies for HS and things that they might have heard about online or from other sources about risks that might not be real risks or really important risks for HS patients specifically. I would love for you to talk more about how you address that, the risks, like the real risks versus the, you know, theoretical or rumored risks. Like, how do you dispel some of those myths? And I'm particularly thinking about something we struggle with in pediatrics, because you've got two people that you have to convince. You have to convince the patient, but you also have to convince the parent. And I think it's especially difficult when all the parent hears is the potential bad side effects of this medicine without really thinking about the real active bad side effects of their child's uncontrolled disease.
As a parent myself, I can imagine how difficult it is to feel that you're in this position of making a really important decision for somebody who you love and would do anything for, but how consequential that decision feels. And I have a lot of empathy for that positioning. I start, Colleen, exactly kind of where you ended that question, which is helping people understand and really in the context of history taking, ensuring that parents are also hearing what I'm hearing about the ways that this condition is impacting their child's life. Are they able to play sports? Is it hard to walk around at school? You know, are they not going to sleepovers or going over to their friends, not going to their friends' homes because it's embarrassing to go to the bathroom? Or what if somebody sees their armpit? And really making sure that we're starting off all understanding how this condition is impacting their lives today. I talk them through our current understanding of what HS disease progression could look like. Particularly in people who come in with moderate disease, so already have developed tunnels, you know, really talking about what the additional burden of more tunnels in more areas could look like and how that could impact their condition. And then, you know, with that kind of framework, I talk about the medication. So I think there are some medications, particularly biologics, that for multiple reasons, there's a lot of concern around in pediatric and in adult patients. In pediatric patients, I think the fact that these are injectable medications or infused medications is like another barrier, another hurdle for those patients. And I have to say that I think you guys are probably the experts at figuring out how to talk to kids about those medications and those options. So I'd love any tips you'd be willing to share with me about that. But when it comes to parents, I think really talking folks through the data as it relates to HS is super important. So a lot of the data, I'm going to pick on one of our drugs because I think it'll be more tangible this way. So the drug I'm going to pick on is adalimumab. You know, a lot of the data that we have for adalimumab, this drug that's been around for like 30 plus years, does not come from the hidradenitis suppurativa literature. It comes from rheumatoid arthritis. It comes from psoriasis. It comes from other diseases that have different risk factors, affect different patients at different ages. So RA in particular is a condition that typically impacts older adults. RA itself leaves individuals that are affected by it at an increased risk of malignancy and increased risk of serious infections. And in the setting of RA, giving people a drug like adalimumab has been shown to be associated with an increased risk of infection, increased risk of malignancy. And now we have pretty good reanalyzed data that supports that it's not really clear whether the reason we're seeing the increased rates of infection and malignancy are, if that's because of the RA itself or if that's because of adalimumab. And I really walk people through that and then also talk with them about the HS-specific data, which is, I'd say, quite reassuring. HS patients are generally younger and they don't have HS itself. It's not as specifically associated with infection and malignancy risk as some of these other inflammatory and autoimmune conditions. And patients on a drug like HS patients on a drug like adalimumab seem to just have a different risk profile. And I'll say anecdotally, in my own experience, people who have minimal or no other comorbidities associated with their HS really do quite well on biologics broadly. And it's really when folks have chronic pulmonary comorbidities and cardiac comorbidities and diabetes that I start to really think hard about making sure that people are safe on biologics and really counsel them about the risks that they might expect. And in that setting, really, I'm thinking about infection. I have to say it's a pretty rare patient or parent that comes out of that discussion not feeling better about the treatment options that are available for HS. Sometimes it can be a pretty long discussion, and sometimes that discussion can happen over many months of kind of the same just reiteration of the data. You know, at the end of the day, I always tell people, like, my goal is to help you to be pain-free and feel like you have control of your body so that the only time that you have to think about your HS is when you have to take your medicines. And that's where I would like to get you to. And patients are generally on board with that. And if they trust me and they feel good about the discussion we've had about the risks of medications, generally speaking, I'd say we've been able to find a path forward.
One of the things that you alluded to was the stigma associated with this disease and also the impact that the disease can have in patients. And a big concern that has, in my practice, completely skyrocketed is mental health issues associated with many, not only HS, but in general, but definitely commonly seen in our HS patients. Can you tell us a little bit about how you address mental health? How do you screen for mental health concerns in the HS patients?
I think that's a great question and such an important question, Irene, because mental health comorbidities feature so prominently in HS, regardless of the age of patients. This is a condition that is so deeply impacts so many different aspects of people's lives. And in the context of short dermatology visits or even long dermatology visits, you can have an entire conversation about HS and all the treatments and all the things and not even begin to touch on mental health comorbidities. And I'd say that that's something that we as dermatologists really need to shift our thinking on. In my own practice, I tend to acknowledge that people are struggling with a lot and that this disease has significant impacts on one's ability to function and do the kind of activities that folks would like to do. And I just really ask directly about feelings of depression, feelings of anxiety, and create a space where it's okay to talk about that and acknowledge that so many people with this condition struggle with these feelings. And it's okay and understandable that that's the case and that my job is to help people find support in that context. And in general, I'd say if I don't recognize it from my patients just in speaking with them, people are pretty forthright in talking about how HS has impacted them. I think in terms of what I do with that information, it really depends on who I'm talking with. And I would love to hear from your perspective, from a pediatric dermatology perspective, how you all handle this. In my adult patients, I'm pretty quick to pull out duloxetine and start folks on an SSRI and with close primary care follow-up and feel pretty comfortable doing that. I'd say in pediatric patients, I'm probably a little less comfortable doing that and want to really make sure that pediatricians are on board with my plan to be a mental health provider in addition to a dermatologist and want to make sure I have good input and support from
from pediatrics, but I would love to learn from you all how you think about this and how you approach this.
I'm very, very fortunate that we have a psychologist who works in our dermatology clinic. And so not just HS, but we can send her, you know, patients with needle phobia, patients with chronic illness of any kind that are depressed or anxious and have, you know, problems related to that. I'm repeatedly surprised, not necessarily in a good way, about the number of times where I think I have a sense of how a patient is generally feeling. And then she will go in the room and talk to them and come back and be like, oh my gosh, that kid is super depressed. Like, I have to make a safety contract with them. I'm worried about them. And I have not always been able to tell, even after a very extensive discussion about how their HS impacts their life. And something I think I have noticed, and I think the data backs this up, is I think sometimes we conflate that impact of HS on your quality of life with your likelihood of having depression or anxiety. And just because your HS isn't that bad, even if it's well controlled, doesn't mean that you can't have depression or anxiety that is very poorly controlled, entirely unrelated to your HS. And I think that's something that we may get comfortable once patients are doing well on their treatment, be like, okay, great, you're doing good, things are going great, fantastic. But trying to remember that those mental health comorbidities are not just how HS makes you feel, they're true comorbidities and comorbid conditions.
I was just going to share that we have taken a little bit of a different approach in our clinic. Like, we started an HS clinic last year, and we're fortunate that we have a social worker physically in running the clinic with us. So what we decided to do was that when they register, they get like, some tools that they need to complete. They complete a depression score, an anxiety score, and CDLQI. So we score them before the medical team goes in to see them. And every single patient that comes to that clinic meets with a social worker and they have a one-to-one. And definitely, like, if a patient comes for the first time to my clinic, I don't have the ability to do all this. And what we have been finding, similarly to Colleen, is that so many of them, it was nowhere in their charts, like nobody had had that conversation with them. And through the scoring and through the conversations, like, we have definitely made many more referrals. Like, I'm not comfortable starting SSRIs. So they do get referred to our psychiatry team for management, but we're not doing it ourselves.
Yeah, I think this point that both you and Colleen make about disease severity not correlating with comorbidity or even really quality of life impact is such an important point, and one that I remember kind of early on in my, I guess, in my trajectory of becoming an HS doctor. I still remember the room I saw this patient in, this young woman who had very mild disease but was so distressed by her disease. And really, I was so struck enough by this presentation that she stays with me today. She was so distraught. And I remember walking out of that room and not really understanding her distress because I couldn't physically see it on her skin. And I think really we've learned so much about how HS impacts people's lives and their sense of self over the last decade that we didn't understand at the time when I saw that patient. And so I think this is really just like an important point to highlight that disease severity really does not necessarily correlate with impact on quality of life and depression and anxiety associated with HS. So perhaps screening or some kind of more formal system to assess for mental health comorbidities is warranted in this patient population.
You know, we've touched on here a couple of different examples of why this disease is so impactful, why it's so important to recognize, you know, and things that we've learned as people who take care of a lot of patients with this condition. How do we educate frontline providers who may not even know what it is in order to get them to understand how important and impactful this condition can be and how to recognize it and refer appropriately?
Gosh, Colleen, that's like the $1 million question.
If only I knew.
Sorry to throw that at you.
No, I mean, I think it's such an important question and one that so many of us are thinking about together, right? How do we get this information to the people who are in a position to make a difference for these patients? I think the HS Foundation is trying really hard to increase disease state awareness and just really put HS top of mind for the general public in collaboration with a lot of pharmaceutical companies as well, because this is, of course, an effort that requires a lot of dollars to get the words hidradenitis suppurativa in front of as many people as is possible. Personally, I think that increasing awareness of hidradenitis suppurativa in the general population is as important as increasing awareness of HS among frontline providers. And I say that because if people come knocking on their primary care provider's door saying, hey, I think I have this condition that I cannot pronounce that's called HS, then those physicians or frontline providers are really going to be held to task to know what this is and how to treat this condition. And they're going to learn. And that's in some ways how all of us continue to learn the practice of medicine. Things come to our door and we have to learn them. So I think that's one important piece. In terms of educating frontline providers, there's such a huge effort ongoing by multiple parties to try and participate in CME activities, include information about HS in the literature of frontline providers. I think the other important place where we have an opportunity to make a big impact is in medical schools, right? All medical students do not get dermatology education. Those that do might be lucky to get a week, and the week they get, they probably learn about psoriasis, eczema, and acne, right? And no shade to psoriasis, eczema, and acne. Those are very common skin conditions, but so is hidradenitis suppurativa. And so even if we could get a mention, I think that'd be great. It'd be something people have heard of, learn a little bit about. And then we're really talking about learning at scale, impacting the learning of an entire generation of physicians. So I think these are some of the ways that we go about that, but it's going to take all of us to action that.
I'm wondering, is there anything else you do differently in your pediatric HS patients, or any other ways that you think about treatment or diagnosis differently in your pediatric patients?
Yeah, I'd say for me, when I see pediatric patients, adolescent patients with HS, I think of it as a real opportunity. In some cases, a very different opportunity than what may be possible in some of the adult patients I see to change the trajectory of somebody's disease. Because I typically, when I'm seeing them, they're so early in their disease course that the opportunity to aggressively manage somebody's HS at a young age and allow children and adolescents to engage in the work of being children and adolescents is a real privilege to be able to afford them. So although I'd say I'm pretty aggressive at managing HS in adult patients too, I really take a concerted approach to thinking early about biologics in pediatric and adolescent patients with HS, which I know a lot of my pediatric derm colleagues also do, and really hold the hands of pediatricians who may be referring their patients to me and help them think about kind of what the long-term implications of managing this disease is for their pediatric patients. So I'd say probably the most important thing I do for my pediatric HS patients are early and aggressive disease management. Also helping raise awareness among pediatric providers about comorbidities that are associated with HS and partnering with them in comorbidity management.
So we're all very excited about all the research that is going on. And what are some research projects that you know of that excite you and that you find might give us some of the answers that we're seeking? Also kind of part of this question, what do you think are the gaps or what research is missing for us to understand HS and its management better?
I mean, I think there's still so much to learn about HS. We're just scratching the surface in our understanding of this condition. The good news, though, is that there probably has never been a better time to have or study this condition than today, because there are a lot of people interested in understanding this condition and a lot of money pouring into this space to advance our knowledge of HS. First and foremost, I guess I'll talk about something that I've been leading, which is an effort called HS Progress, but stands for Hidradenitis Suppurativa Prospective Observational Registry and Biospecimen Repository. And the goal of HS Progress is really to understand HS clinical course, to understand kind of who are the people that are impacted by this condition, how does their disease progress, and what are the factors that we can learn in understanding their disease progression? What are the factors we can leverage to better understand who's going to be appropriate for what treatments, whose disease is going to respond to this biologic versus that, and how do we improve outcomes for these patients? And that's an effort that is ongoing across 16 different academic centers at the United States, all of which have an HS expert at the helm, and an effort that Pedra has helped us organize around. And I'm really excited about the potential for that work, because I think we're going to learn just a ton about HS that's going to directly impact patient care through that effort. I think taking it kind of down to the basics of what we need to learn, we still don't have a good sense of HS prevalence worldwide. And there's an effort ongoing that's led by Professor Gregory Yemek in Denmark called GIZA, which is really a Herculean effort that feels like it would have been impossible for anyone else besides him to undertake, to understand the prevalence of HS all over the world. And he's found partners in over 100 countries to assess HS prevalence in these various pockets of the world, so that we'll have a better sense of actually how prevalent is this condition, so we have better data to work with. And that work is being done in conjunction with the ILDS, the International League of Dermatologic Societies. We also have a lot of work to do to better measure HS disease activity and response to therapies. And that is work that's being undertaken by a group called Historic, led by John Ingram and Amit Garg, and has made a lot of progress in terms of helping us think about what the best ways to measure HS are, so that once we have promising therapies for this condition, we can actually get those therapies from an idea through FDA approval and ultimately available to patients who need these medications. There's some ongoing work to better understand the causes of HS, and specifically the genetic causes of HS. And that work, actually very interestingly, is ongoing across multiple groups worldwide. There's a group, a joint group between UCSF and Henry Ford that's doing this work. Chris Syed's group at UNC Chapel Hill is also interested in this space. And Lynn Pechkova, who's moving to New York University in collaboration with her European colleagues, have also embarked on this work. And what is most exciting, I think, is that although there are three different groups doing this work, the results that they're coming up with are very aligned. So they're validating one another's work. And then I'd also just point you to some recent work published in JAMA Dermatology on HS in Maltese population, just published by Dr. Mintoff. And I think we are in a really unique position to better understand the causes of HS through genetic studies, and that population, kind of founder populations, are a unique way for us to deeply understand the initial mechanisms of disease. So I think I could probably go on and on about the gaps in the field and areas where we have work to do, but I think these are some of
the really exciting organized efforts that exist to understand HS and that are really going to make an impact in our space over the coming years.
That all sounds like such exciting research, and there's so much of it. And I know that at least at this time, like with most research, it needs starts in adults and then eventually will move to include our adolescent population. And I'm just curious your thoughts on how pediatric dermatologists or other people who take care of pediatric patients with HS, you know, can prepare to help support these initiatives if and when they start to include this patient population.
Yeah, I mean, I think HS is such a unique condition insofar as that this is a condition that we think in its most typical manifestation really first impacts adolescents. So I would say that all of these efforts should include pediatric and adolescent patients. And all of these efforts would benefit from the perspective of pediatric dermatologists, both in terms of their clinical experience, but also in terms of their research experience and informing tools that are being developed for clinical trials. Is it appropriate for us to use the outcome measures that we use for adults, for pediatric patients? I think in HS Progress in particular, we'd love to see pediatric dermatologists partner with the sites that have that are part of this effort to make sure that we're able to enroll and capture data on pediatric and adolescent patients. I think, you know, certainly the genetic studies would benefit enormously from triads or trios of parents and children with affected with HS to better understand the genetics of HS. So from my perspective, I would love to have a pediatric dermatology partner or several partners thinking about all of the work that's ongoing and also leading work that you all think is pertinent for specifically for pediatric and adolescent HS patients. Who do have unique considerations when it comes to treatment, who kind of are uniquely situated for early and aggressive management and helping folks who are, I'd say, historically adult dermatologists think about how we can do better by the pediatric and adolescent patient population.
So one thing that we have alluded to is the phenotyping of the disease, Haley. Is that something that you actively do in your patient population? Is it something that we should be doing more in our pediatric patients? How do you see that being different for our pediatric patients?
I'd say that all of us who take care of HS patients, I think, recognize that not all HS walks in the door looking the same, right? HS has different subtypes, phenotypes, flavors, whatever you want to call it. Those of us who treat this condition, whether we're formally putting people into phenotype buckets or not, are recognizing that young, thin men with primarily gluteal HS are fundamentally different than women who have HS in a very typical distribution in the axilla, under the breasts, and in the brain. And that the trajectory of disease in these two different types of patients may be completely different and require a different level of aggressive management. I think in recent years, many of us who planted our flag in the sand and said, hey, we take care of HS patients, are seeing more mild HS walking through the door, and also now are seeing that there is a variant of HS that just doesn't seem to progress. And I'd say this is like also a big therapeutic gap. How do we manage these patients who have mild disease and talk with them about their risks of disease progression? And it's really an open question. To the question about disease phenotyping, what we know and how we use it in management, I think this is really an open question. I think what we know is that these different phenotypes exist, and there's now been a handful of studies really trying to think thoughtfully about these phenotypes and put them into buckets. I think what would be very valuable is to have biologic evidence that these phenotypes are different, whether it's by prognostic markers or predictive biomarkers, to help us better understand if what we're seeing clinically is also biologically different and
if these people should be getting a certain type of therapy or if their disease would be more responsive to, you know, a JAK inhibitor, TNF inhibitor, an IL-17 inhibitor, or what have you. We don't have that yet. I mean, that's one of the goals of HS progress. That's one of the things that we're really trying to do, try to better understand, correlating clinical course with biomarkers and really being able to provide people with the treatment they need as early as we're able to give it to them. So it's a hot topic. It's an area of ongoing investigation. And for now, I'd say, as clinicians and as investigators, we play an important role in recognizing these phenotypes and helping to drive the research that'll help us understand what to do for these patients.
I think those are some really good points. I think another thing that doesn't necessarily go along with phenotyping, it doesn't, you know, always match one-to-one, but I think is another thing we notice as people who take care of HS is that different ethnicities seem to be affected either more severely or more frequently than others. Can you talk a little bit about that? Have you seen any differences between adults and pediatric patients in terms of ethnicity?
I think we know that based on U.S. epidemiologic data that HS disproportionately affects women and seems to disproportionately affect Black Americans. I think there's now at least one well-done study that shows that Black Americans tend to have more severe HS than other racial and ethnic groups. What's not clear from these data is why. Is there something genetically different, or is this related to a lack of treatment access in some patient populations? And what role social determinants of health play in HS disease course and disease progression? And I think these are really open questions that are the basis of ongoing investigation. There's an investigator here at University of California, San Francisco. Her name is Eileen Chang, who's really interested in understanding the intersection of social determinants of health and inflammatory skin disorders with a focus on hidradenitis suppurativa. So I think we're going to learn a lot more about this in the coming years. But the observation that you mentioned is a real one. And I think it's something we all see in our clinical practices. The question really is why do we see it?
Yeah, I do think that sort of is reflected in my patient population as well. I think that, you know, I've trained in a lot of different places that have had sort of a different general background of skin types and ethnicities. And in the places that I've practiced that have a larger Hispanic population and a larger Black American population, that I definitely see more HS in those areas. And I don't just think that it's related to, I don't know that it's fully related to social determinants of health. But again, to your point, you know, the data doesn't say why, and we really aren't able to answer that question yet. And unfortunately, those things often go hand in hand.
Haley, one thing that we would like you to comment on is why you think HS is so different from patient to patient.
Well, Irene, I think that's a really important question. And I think in my mind, there is no doubt that there is some component of this disease that is genetic and some component that is related to environment. I think one of the best examples of this is that when we look at the worldwide HS prevalence data and some of the prospectively collected prevalence data through the GISA study, what we've seen is that although HS disproportionately affects African Americans, the prevalence rates of HS on the African subcontinent do not mirror what we see in the United States. But in more developed nations like South Africa, some of the most recent data that was presented at the European HS Foundation meeting earlier this month showed that actually the prevalence rates of HS in South Africa among Black South Africans mirrors what we see in the United States. So I think there's definitely some environmental component. What that is, I think, remains to be better understood, but really having strong prevalence data and having and being able to prospectively follow patients, not just understanding their disease biology, but understanding the environments in which they live, grow, work, exist in is just going to be an important part of us being able to take better care of patients affected by this condition.
I would like to ask you an imaginative question. You know, where would you hope, if in an ideal world, where would we be with HS research 5 years from now?
I think that's a great question. And I hope it's not really an imaginative question. I mean, I think about where we started with HS, or where I started with HS a little more than 10 years ago, which dates me, but where we were then compared with where we are now is leap years ahead. Given how much interest there is in HS research and HS therapeutic development, I think a lot is possible in 5 years. My hope for this field is that you have a much clearer understanding of HS epidemiology, a much clearer understanding of what these HS phenotypes mean for our patients and mean for disease management. My hope, and I think this will be a reality, is that we'll have better outcome measures for HS that help us get treatments from, you know, an idea stage down the therapeutic pipeline and onto the market for our patients in short order, much faster than we've been able to do that to date. And I hope we'll have a better understanding of what causes HS and how we can modify some of those factors to change the trajectory of disease. And my hope, and really my charge for dermatology and pediatric dermatology, is that we really do a better job of integrating pediatric and adolescent HS into all of our adult HS studies, so that we can understand HS across the spectrum of the lifespan and do right by all of our patients, do better by all of our patients with HS.
Thank you so much, Dr. Nayak, for joining us. I've really enjoyed this discussion and hearing so much about your research, the research of so many other people in the field. And we really look forward to working with you again in the future and hopefully, you know, helping to advance our knowledge and understanding of pediatric HS.
Thank you so much to Dr. Haley Nayak for joining us in our first episode of Unraveling HS, Exploring Hidradenitis Suppurativa Research. And also thank you to our program hosts, Dr. Colleen Cotton and Dr. Irene Lara Corrales. If you have questions about this podcast or about HS and the research PEDRA is supporting, please email us at info@pedraresearch.org. I would like to thank our sponsors for this program, Insight and Novartis. This is an independent medical education program. And make sure you're staying up to date on all your PEDRA activities by tracking us on our social media channels at PEDRA Research. And make sure you like and subscribe to our PEDRA Pearls podcast channel so you never miss an episode. Thanks so much for listening.